Before we begin today talking about mediated discourse analysis, I'd just like to review a little bit what we talked about last week. And mainly what we were talking about last week was trying to figure out what this word discourse means. And we had a long conversation because we realized that actually the word discourse has lots of different meanings and can be used in lots of different ways. So I kind of summarized on this slide the main things that I think we settled on last week in terms of the definition of discourse. The most basic definition of discourse, as we said last week, was studying language beyond the sentence or beyond the clause. Okay? If you're just studying sentences, if you're just studying clauses, then you're not studying discourse. You're studying sentences. Right? You're studying grammar, maybe, or syntax, or some other field of linguistics that's interested in maybe how words are put together or how sentences are put together. But discourse analysts are interested in how texts are put together or how conversations are put together or how interactions are put together or how, a term that we'll talk about next week, how speech events are put together. Right? So discourse analysts take a kind of big view. Right? They try to analyze the big thing rather than the small thing. Second important point we made last week was the idea that discourse is language in use, right? That it's not studying language in an abstract way, like reading a grammar book or reading a dictionary or something like that. It's going out and actually seeing how people actually use the language, right? It's one thing to analyze, for example, a newspaper or something like that, but your analysis of the stories in the newspaper really doesn't make much sense unless you know what people actually do with the stories in this newspaper. For example, does anybody actually read this newspaper? Or do they just use the newspaper to wrap their fish in the market? Right? So here you are, you've done all this discourse analysis on this article from this newspaper, and you find out that actually nobody ever read this article, they just wrapped their fish in this article, right? Then your discourse analysis is useless. So one very, very key point for discourse analysts is that we're trying to find out how people actually use discourse, right? How people actually use language in the real world, which is why I've asked all of you to choose, you know, some kind of site of investigation that you're going to be looking at this semester, right? Because that's an example of the real world, right? So every week, try to look at the real world and say, okay, this is what we talked about in class. How can I see some kind of example about this way of discourse use in real life, in the real situation, right? So related to that was the idea that discourse is related somehow to action, right? That discourse is something that we do actions with, right? That we use discourse as a kind of tool to perform some kinds of actions. In other words, we do things with words, or we do things with discourse. And this is a theme that we're going to come back to over and over and over again in this course, the relationship between discourse and action. But it's going to be the particular subject of today's lecture, because today's lecture has all to do with the relationship between discourse and action. The kind of discourse analysis we're going to be talking about today, it's really kind of funny to start off with this kind of analysis because this is really the newest form of discourse analysis, right? And we might think, oh, it's such a new one, maybe we should leave it to the end, do the older ones first and then work our way up to the new one. But I decided to start with mediated discourse analysis because I think the principles in mediated discourse analysis are so important when you first start out analyzing discourse, because they help you to understand and they help you to determine which kind of discourse to analyze. Right? The fact is, if you're going to waste your time doing something so difficult and so boring as discourse analysis, you might as well be analyzing some kind of meaningful discourse. You don't want to waste your time analyzing the wrong discourse, the discourse that is somehow irrelevant to what you're trying to find out. For example, if I want to analyze the discourse of this classroom, right, I'd like to do an analysis of the discourse of this classroom, and so I'm going to choose a text from this classroom starting out, and I'm going to analyze that. I'm going to choose this text right here. This says, protect environment, use less energy, switch off before you leave. Facilities Management Office, inquiry number 8833. So I'm going to analyze that text. Think it's a good idea? If I want to understand what's going on socially, what's going on in this classroom, if I want to understand the communication among the people in this classroom, do you think it would be a good idea to analyze that text? Now, has anyone in this room ever read that text? This is probably the first, you probably didn't even know that text was there until I just read it to you, right? Well, now you know it's there. So the thing about that text, yes, it's there. That is a text, and that is here. That is discourse, and that is here, right? But to analyze that text, to understand the interaction between the people in this classroom would be ridiculous because it's irrelevant. Because we're not using that text, right? That text isn't being used by you or me or anyone else in this classroom to do anything. It's just kind of there. It's just like wallpaper, you know? It's just kind of there in the background. Doesn't really have any effect on us, right? Whereas this text, right, is actually much more important because I'm actually using this text, right, to explain a concept to you, right? And so this text is actually central to one of the actions, that is the action of explaining, that's going on in this classroom, right? So this is the key, and this is where mediated discourse analysis starts. See, mediated discourse analysis says the traditional way of discourse analysis has a problem, right? The traditional way of discourse analysis is that I go and I look for a text or a conversation to analyze, and then I take into account the context, right? So I choose the text, and then everything outside of this text is the context. Now that's not a bad idea. That's the way most people go about it, right? So maybe I'm interested in business letters, right? So I go into a company and I look at the sales letters, right? And then I take into account the other things around, right? Like the conversations people have about the sales letters and the relationships between the boss and the secretary and all these sort of things. I would count that as context. But the problem is, who is deciding what the important text is? It's me. And I don't even work at this company. I've just already decided that this is the important text to analyze, got in there and analyzed, and decided that everything else was just kind of background information, secondary information, context. And there's a problem with this. I first really realized this problem when I was teaching in the computer labs down on the second floor. Right? Have you ever taken a course down in one of the computer rooms down there? Yeah, some of you have, yeah. Well, I was teaching a course there, right, and I had my discourse, I had my texts, right, I had my PowerPoint, and I had my explanations and my spoken language, and I was talking, and all of the students were sitting in their chairs quietly, very politely, sitting behind their computer screens, chatting on MSN, yes? And so my feeling, right, was that, wait a minute, this is the text, I am the text, right, and all of this other stuff you're doing with the MSN, that's just context, you know, that's the context, but, you know, you shouldn't pay attention to that, you should pay attention to this, because this is the real text. But then it occurred to me that that was only my point of view, right, that was just because of my particular position, maybe because my particular prejudices, right? From the point of view of the students sitting in the chairs, the real text was their MSN conversation. That was the thing that they were focused on, wasn't it? That was the real text. I was just context, right? My lesson was just the context for them to have their MSN conversation, right? And it's really true, isn't it? And so to really understand what was going on in that classroom, I need not just to analyze this kind of stuff. I also need to analyze their MSN conversations, right? Because it's their MSN conversations that they're focused on, yeah? It's their MSN conversations that they're actually using to do certain kinds of social actions in that kind of situation, right? So different people will use different texts in the same situation to do different actions. But the whole point of mediated discourse analysis is you can't decide what the text is beforehand. Right? You can only decide what the text is by first analyzing what people are doing. Yeah? What kind of actions they're taking with the text. And so maybe the theme of mediated discourse analysis should be the expression, actions speak louder than words. Right? That before we can even get to analyzing the discourse, first we got to think about the actions. Right? Think about what people are actually doing. What's going on? And so with mediated discourse analysis, we start with the action. And instead of looking at the discourse and trying to figure out its relationship to the action, we look at the action. And we ask, well, this action is being taken. Are people using discourse to take this action? Or are they using other things to take this action? Because actually, quite a lot of actions are taken without very much discourse. Right? Sometimes discourse is totally unimportant to the action being taken. And just because we're discourse analysts doesn't mean that discourse is actually so important. Sometimes discourse is not important at all. Right? So why waste our time studying the discourse if discourse is not important for this kind of action? So first question we ask is, what's going on here? Right? So you go into your site of investigation. First question you ask is, what's going on here? What are people doing here? Okay, it's my family. Oh, they're having dinner. They're scolding my younger brother, right? My parents are arguing about money, right? We're discussing whether we should buy a new flat, right? We're playing mahjong together, right? We're preparing food together, right? So many, many different actions that you do, right? So first thing is you go, okay, what are the actions? And not only what are the actions, but what are the key actions? What are the important actions? Right? So, for example, if you go to the company, right? You go to your company. What are the important actions? Well, maybe interacting with customers. That's an important action. Maybe having a meeting. That's an important action. Maybe going to lunch with your coworkers. That's an important action. Going to the toilet. Maybe it's not such an important action. Well, it's an important action, yes. Definitely an important action, but maybe not important for this particular community, right? In some situations, it's very important. For example, if you go to bars, clubs, or discos, right? And in such places, it's often that the girls will go to the toilet together. You ever notice that? All the girls go to the powder room together, right? And then they gossip about their boyfriends outside, right? In that kind of situation, going to the toilet is an extremely important action. It's a key action, right? But maybe in your company, it's not such a key action, right? So it's going to be different for every place, right? So you got to determine, okay, what are the actions that people are doing? You just kind of list them. What are the actions that people are doing? And then say, okay, but what are the really key actions, right? What are the really important actions, right? The actions that if we didn't do this action, we couldn't do our job as a company. If we didn't have this action, we couldn't be a very good family. Right? If we didn't have this action, we couldn't be a basketball team. Right? For example, the action of playing basketball would be a key action for your basketball team, because if you didn't play basketball, then you wouldn't be a basketball team. Right? So that's key to your identity as a basketball team. So you identify the key actions. You don't waste your time studying discourse that's not linked to the key actions. Okay? So you don't waste your time studying discourse like wireless LAN here. Yeah, because it has nothing to do with the key actions that you've identified. Right? So the first step in mediated discourse analysis, and this is a step that will help you in all of your other kinds of discourse analysis around your site of investigation, is that, okay, there's all this discourse here. How do I know which discourse to study? How do I know which discourse to analyze? And the way to know that is first to identify the actions. So what are actions? Well, actions are what we do every day. Our lives are made up of actions. We do one action after another. We can't stop doing actions. As soon as we wake up in the morning, we start doing actions, right? We wake up, we get out of bed, we brush our teeth, we eat our breakfast, we argue with our mother, we go to school, right? We buy something at the shop. Over and over again, we do action after action after action after action until we go to sleep at night. And even when we're sleeping, we're doing action because we're dreaming, right? And so action is basically what our lives are made of, right? Our lives are made up of actions. But our actions are very important, actually, because it's through our actions that we, show other people who we are, right? And also we show other people who we think they are, right? So, for example, your action of walking into the classroom and sitting down on a chair, right, is an action that shows that you think that you're a student, right? And my action of standing up in front of the classroom is an action that shows that I think I'm a teacher, right? Everything we do shows somehow who we think we are and who we think the other people are. But the fact is, we can't just take our actions alone, right? We need some kind of help to take our actions. For example, if I'm teaching a class, I need to use some kind of tools to teach the class. For example, I need to use the PowerPoint presentation. If I don't have the PowerPoint presentation, maybe I can still teach the class, but it's maybe not so easy, right? So this helps me to teach the class. I use this as a tool to take this action, right? Another thing I really need to use to take the action of teaching this class is I need to use the tool of language, yeah? English language, right? So I use the tool of English language to mediate my ideas. If I didn't have this language, if I just stood in front of the class, then it wouldn't be a very good class, would it? You wouldn't get too much out of it. Yeah? And so I need to use this other tool, this language, right? And so all actions, right, are mediated, we say mediated, through cultural tools. We call these cultural tools, right? Such as PowerPoint presentations, language, tape recorders, microphones, taxis, cups, overhead projectors, computers, ideas, memories, plans, things like this. All of these are cultural tools. And so the actions that we take, right, depend on the cultural tools that we have to take them. Right? Sometimes we don't have the cultural tools available to take the actions. For example, maybe the computer's not working. Right? Maybe I can't use my PowerPoint. Right? Maybe I got sick, I lost my voice, I can't talk. Right? If I don't have this tool available to me, then I can't take the action. Right? You can't take the action of teaching this class because you don't have the tools available to you. Right? First of all, you don't have a computer with a PowerPoint on it, right, for you to take the action. Right? You don't have this desk here to give you so much authority to teach the class. You don't have a PhD. Yeah? Sorry. But you don't have a PhD. And my PhD is a tool that I can use to get a job so that I can come here and teach you about discourse and pragmatics, right? If I don't have that tool, I can't do this job, right? If I just come, you know, and say, oh yeah, you know, 4 or 5 standards, right? They wouldn't give me the job, right? And so even things like degrees and certificates and titles and stuff like that are very, very important cultural tools. So this is the idea, yeah, that we always take actions, and we always take actions with other people. Sometimes we take actions to other people or with other people, right? So here's you are the actor, yeah? Here's the other person, they are the other person, yeah? Now, that's all well and good, but we can't actually just take this action without anything to take it with. We need to have some kind of tool to take it with. And so all of our actions are mediated through different kinds of cultural tools. So what are cultural tools? Well, there are basically two kinds of cultural tools. Right? One kind we can call technical tools because they're actually physical things. They're physical tools, like a screwdriver, like a hammer, right? Like a pencil, right? Like a computer. These are all technical tools. right? A text is also a technical tool, right? So, for example, this card is a text, right? I can use this card as an object, as a technical tool. For example, when I take the roll and I put the card in this pile of all the bad people in this pile here, right? I'm using this card as a tool to take the action, right? To make you feel bad, to make you feel guilty, right? Things like that, right? So, and it really actually doesn't matter what it says on the card very much, right? The words on the card don't matter very much other than the fact that it has your name on it and not Janice's name on it, right? But it's really not important for me to analyze, you know, BAEP year two or any of that stuff, right? All these things are not so important for the way I use the card. I kind of use the card more as an object, right? And you can see it. You can see it and you feel this fear. Oh, no, he's holding my card. That's my card, right? And so that's how we use the card. So texts, we can see text as these kind of physical things, right, that we use. The words maybe are not so important, right? So, for example, when you read a newspaper, right, you can use the newspaper to perform the action of reading, yeah? But you can also use a newspaper to perform many other kinds of actions, right? So you can use your newspaper to hit your dog, right? You can use a newspaper to hide behind, right? If, you know, somebody on the MTR is looking at you, right, and you don't want them to look at you, you can hide behind your newspaper, right? You can use a newspaper to watch somebody. If you see, oh, a really cute guy, a really cute girl, you could, you know, kind of look at them. Maybe put two little in the newspaper, something like this, right? So in this case, the text, it's used as an object, isn't it? Right? It's not so much used as language, but it's used as an object, right? So texts, machines like computers, cars, coffee makers, all these sorts of things, and objects. Objects like, you know, this, and objects like cups, right? All of these are important cultural tools. I'm taking the action of drinking this tea. This action is mediated through this cup, yeah? If I don't have this cup, I can't do the action, can I? Very difficult, I think impossible, right, to do the action of drinking the tea without having this object, the cup, to mediate between me and the tea. And even other people, right, even other people's bodies can also be considered cultural tools, right? So, for example, if I want to teach you, right, how to play tennis or something, right, and then I'll ask Janice, oh, Janice, could you come up, please? And then I could use Janice's body, right, to show you, right, how to swing the tennis racket, right? Or if you're in a bank and then a bank robber comes and you're with your boyfriend, right, and the bank robber starts shooting people, right, then you can hide behind your boyfriend, right? So you're using your boyfriend's body as a cultural tool to protect you from the bullets of the bank robber. Right? And so even people's bodies, we actually use people's bodies as cultural tools. But we don't just use these physical tools, right? We also have a number of mental tools, right? They're not actually objects or physical things outside in the world, but they're inside our head, right? We call these semiotic tools or symbolic tools. And these are things like languages, right? I have the tool of the English language. You have the tool of the English language as well. That's why I can talk to you. Right? So languages, counting systems, right? Being able to count. We have a uniform counting system here, right? We all count in the same way. We measure our money in the same way. The system of measuring money is an important tool, right, for us to buy things. If we didn't have this system in our minds, we wouldn't be able to do it. Genres, social languages, special ways of speaking, anything, registers, sociolects, any special kind of language is also a cultural tool that you can use to do things with, right? And so you will use certain kinds of language when you're playing basketball and other kinds of language when you're talking to your boss, right? You wouldn't, you know, maybe in playing basketball, use some foul language, yeah? So that foul language is a cultural tool that you use to perform the action of maybe insulting your friend or playing with your friend or joking with your friend, something like that. And that tool is available to you in the basketball situation. And you can take it and you can use it. In your work situation, when you have a customer coming into the YMCA, right, you don't have the tool of the foul language to use, okay? Or you may have it, but you don't want to use it, if you know what I mean, right? Because it's not appropriate to use in that situation. It actually won't help you do the action of serving the customer well, right? It will actually help you to do other actions like getting fired, things like that. And so any kind of way of speaking, our idea about time, right? Our concept of time is a cultural tool. Certain kind of rules we have. So we have certain rules in the university about, you know, you're not supposed to smoke in the classroom, you're not supposed to drink coffee in the classroom, or things like this, right? And we all kind of, you know, try to follow the rules. Any kind of systems or labels or social identities or communities or memories, any of these things, these kind of abstract things, we use them as cultural tools to do things. So some cultural tools are physical, like this pen, but some cultural tools are mental or symbolic, right? So I'd like to go back to last week's conversation that we looked at, right? Now, we spent a lot of time looking at the discourse last week, but from the point of view of mediated discourse analysis, there are lots of other things that we would want to consider in this situation, right? We would want to consider, well, what are the other kinds of cultural tools that people have available in this situation, and how do they use those tools to take actions? And one of the tools that the man, who's the boss, has available to him is the telephone. And so the woman is making her complaint and saying, well, I've been overlooked quite a few times, but I wanted to find out specifically how, what I could do to help myself be considered next time. And then the man says, can I just grab that phone? Sorry about that. And the woman says, okay. Right? Now, from the point of view of mediated discourse analysis, this is a very important action. He's taking the action of answering the phone. But by taking the action of answering the phone, he's also taking another kind of action. He's taking the action of communicating that he is superior to her. Because think about it, right? She might have a phone too. Maybe she has a mobile phone, right, in her pocket. And she's in her boss's office talking to her boss. You're in your boss's office talking to your boss, right? And your mobile phone rings. You say, oh, excuse me, let me just get that. Right? Oh, hi, Mom. Right? You think it's a good idea? Bad idea. Bad idea. You won't do it, right? In fact, you don't even have this available to you. Even though you have a mobile phone in your hand, you cannot answer it. Even though I have a mobile phone in my pocket, right, and it was just ringing a little while ago, right, I couldn't answer it. Right? So that tool actually wasn't even available to me. Right? Because in this kind of situation, I'm teaching a class, I can't answer a mobile phone. Right? And so even though I have it, it's not available to me. I can't use it. Right? So here, the telephone is available to the man, but not available to the woman, right? And that's key, right? Because that shows you some very important difference about their power, right? The power that they have. Second, he chose to use the telephone in the action of answering the telephone, right? That was a choice he made, you know? He didn't have to answer the telephone, right? He's the boss. He probably has a secretary to answer his telephone, right? If he just waits, lets it ring for a little while, then maybe the secretary will pick it up, right? But he chose to answer the telephone. And one of the reasons, I suggest, that he chose to answer the telephone was because that's a way of showing her, you have to wait for me. Yeah? You have to wait for me. I'm the one who decides what happens here. I'm the one who decides what kind of actions we take. And I'm taking the action of answering the telephone. And you have to wait. Right? So it's a way of showing power. Right? It's a way of showing how much power he has over her. But then something else happens at the same time in the conversation. It's a bit strange. The man says it's part of the communication, and the woman says, okay, I'll turn this off. Tom's on the phone, I'll just turn this off. And the tape recorder is switched off. And then after a little while, then the tape recorder switched on again, and the woman says, "Tom just finished the phone conversation." And so from this we can see that, okay, the man, he has a cultural tool. He has a telephone. He can use his telephone. But she actually has a cultural tool as well, which is something that we kind of forgot while we were analyzing the conversation last week. We forgot this very, very critical aspect of this conversation, that the woman, right, was holding a tape recorder throughout the entire conversation, right? And that's so key, isn't it? That's really, really key. It probably affected the whole conversation, you know, because, you know, now the boss can't say anything that he can get sued for, or, you know, some discrimination ordinance suit or something like this. He has to be very careful because it's being tape recorded. He knows it's being tape recorded, right? And so she has a cultural tool, and she is using this cultural tool, though, in the opposite way that he was. Right? He uses his telephone to show her that he's more powerful. He can do anything he wants. Right? She uses the tape recorder to show him that she thinks he's more powerful, and she's going to be polite by turning off the tape recorder while he has his private phone conversation. Right? So she uses the tape recorder to show politeness to him. Right? She uses the telephone to show power over her. And then a little later on in the conversation, they're talking about her performance, and the man is giving her advice and says, "Well, I think you should first obviously acknowledge the point that, you know, there's been some history of tension, but, you know, you're trying to work through these things and you're working on this specific project." And then she says, "Oh, that's finished, yeah." And the man says, "Getting through that, yeah, and I've got the report right here." Yeah, looks very good. "I've got the report right here." Looks very good, right? So the report about this project that she finished is sitting on his desk, right? And he can use this report as a tool, as an object to take some kind of action, right? "I've got your report right here." Looks very good. In fact, he's using it in a very similar way than he's using the telephone, because by saying, "I've got your report right here on my desk, you know," and "I'm saying," it's very good, right? He's just really emphasizing, right, that he's the one who has power over her. He's the one who's going to be evaluating her in terms of her report. But he's also using the report, I think, to show that he's kind of paying attention to her. He's, "Yeah, I understand. I'm monitoring your work. Right? I appreciate your work. I got your report right here." Right? So what's important here about the report is not what's written in the report, is it? Right? The words in the report are totally irrelevant to what he's doing. Right? What's important is the report as an object, right? As a thing, as an actual, you know, set of papers that he can point to, he can hold, he can touch and say, "Yes, I've got it right here." Right? So we can see in this conversation that the people actually use quite a lot of cultural tools other than language. And so I'd like you to consider for a moment a rather ordinary kind of interaction, that is buying a cup of coffee. Has anyone here not bought a cup of coffee? Henry, I see you bought a cup of coffee today. Anyone else? Okay, well, we're not going to go to the coffee cart to buy a cup of coffee. We're going to go to the Pacific Coffee. Not now, okay? But we're going to pretend we're going to the Pacific Coffee to buy a cup of coffee. So buying a cup of coffee, right, is something that requires lots and lots of small actions in order to finally get your cup of coffee, right? So what I would like you to think about are, what are the actions that I have to do in order to buy a cup of coffee at Pacific Coffee? And second, what kind of cultural tools do I need to use, do I need to have access to, in order to do each of these actions? And you can use this little chart. You can use this little chart in week two, this little chart here, right? This one, okay? So just pay attention to the first two columns, actions and cultural tools, right? So what are the actions involved in buying a cup of coffee, and what kind of cultural tools do you use to take each of these actions? So discuss this for about 10 minutes with your classmates, and then we'll get some feedback. Okay, let's get a little bit of feedback from you now. Tell me, what is the first thing that you need to do in order to buy a cup of coffee? What's the first thing you need to do? Read the menu, but there's no menu here. I don't see any menu here. How can I? Oh, you might have to go to the coffee shop. Okay, so every single action, right? The first action, is the first action going to the coffee shop? Okay. So maybe the first action is deciding where to go. I'm going to have a cup of coffee. Am I going to go to the coffee cart or am I going to go to the Pacific Coffee? Right? What kinds of cultural tools do I use to make that decision? Okay, so your memory. Anything else that you can use to make that decision? Hey, I got a little card, right? And every time I go to the Pacific Coffee, they put a little stamp on the card, and then I can get a free cup of coffee, right? And so since I have this little card, I'm going to go to the Pacific Coffee, right? So in this case, I've actually used this little card as a tool to decide whether or not to go to Pacific Coffee. I said, oh, I got this card, I'm going to go to Pacific Coffee, right? Or maybe I got a coupon, free cup of coffee, right? From the newspaper, right? Free cup of coffee, I'll go to the Pacific Coffee, right? Advertisement as well. Advertisement might be a tool that I could use, right, to decide whether to go. So memory or any sort of coupons, cards, ads, lots of different kinds of texts in deciding where to go. So I've decided where to go. Deciding where to go. Yeah? I've decided where to go. I'm going to go to the Pacific Coffee. Right? So the next thing I need to do is I need to get there. How do I get there? Right? Okay. So what kind of cultural tools do I need to get there? What do I need? Can I just like meditate? I'm in the Pacific Coffee. My mind is not so powerful. So I need my body. Very important. I need to use my body. Anything else? Some kind of transportation, right? Now, I think that probably, you know, most of us, if we're going to go to the Pacific Coffee in Festival Walk, we don't need to take a taxi. Yeah. Some people, they want to take a taxi. Oh, let's take a taxi. But we don't need to take a taxi. Yeah, we can walk there. But in walking there, we are going to make use of quite a lot of different cultural tools. And one of the main cultural tools is a kind of machine that carries us from one floor to another floor. Right? So the escalator or the lift, yeah? Or you could use the stairs, and stairs are also a cultural tool. Right? You might use the signs. Right? You might not know where the Pacific Coffee is, so you might want to use the Festival Walk directory. Oh, I want a cup of coffee. Where's the Pacific Coffee? Oh, here it is. It's on the second floor. Right? And then you can go. Right? So all sorts of signs and other things like that, body transportation signs, things like that. Okay. Right. Here I am. I'm at the Pacific Coffee. Right? What do I got to do? What's the next step? Here I am, standing outside the Pacific Coffee. I want a cup of coffee. What do I do? Just shout, give me coffee. What do? I have to go inside, okay? So enter. Enter is an important action that you need to do in order to get your coffee. So you enter. What do you need to use to enter? Okay, your body. What else? Signs. Yeah, definitely. The sign that says Pacific Coffee, because that's how you know it's Pacific Coffee, isn't it? Right? You go into the shop that says Pacific Coffee. You don't go into the shop that says, mandarina duck or something like this, right? You go into Pacific Coffee, right? And if that sign is not there, then you're not going to go in, you know? If the sign's not there, if you're suddenly you're going to Pacific, you're walking to Pacific Coffee, you're about to go, what happened to the Pacific Coffee? Why? Now it's IT. Everything is IT now, right? IT is taking over every shop, right? So you need to have that sign to remind you, okay, this is Pacific Coffee, especially in Hong Kong, because the shops change every week, you know, a different shop is in a different place. So you look at the sign, okay, here's the Pacific Coffee. I got to go inside. What do you need to go inside? Don't you? You need to have a door. Well, okay, we'll call it an entrance. At least you've got to have a way in, you know. If it's a Pacific Coffee, but it's all like closed up with a wall, you can just see a small, and you look inside and people are drinking the coffee, very happy. You can't get in, let me in. Then you can't get your coffee, okay? So you need to have some kind of entrance or some kind of door. And sometimes on the door, there could be some kind of important discourse, all right? What kind of texts do we see on doors? Open, okay, so it will tell you, is the Pacific Coffee open, right? What other kind of text do you see on doors? Pull and push, right? Now, I'm not saying that you always use that text, right? In fact, for most of us, that text has already gotten into our memories. So we don't, every time we go up to a door, we don't go, pull. Right? Because we know, we've been through that door many times. We only have to read the text once. Yeah, but that text is still important. So various kinds of texts, signs saying that how to open the door, whether the coffee shop is open or not. Even, you might have a sign that says, nobody under the age of 18 wearing a school uniform allowed in this coffee shop. Something like that, right? And so there might be some kind of restrictions on the who can enter, and you've got to look for that as well. So here I am. I'm inside the coffee shop, finally. I can smell the aroma of the coffee. I'm really dying for a cup of coffee here. What do I do now? I take a seat? That's it. But where's my coffee? What do I do? What do I have to do to order the coffee? Okay, so I have to go up to the counter. And one of you mentioned actually one of the most important cultural tools in this particular situation, right? And that is the queue. Is that how you spell Q? Yeah, Q. It's a British word, right? In America, we say a line. Yeah, a line. It's the line. It's the Q. Yeah? So you need to have the Q, right? If there are other people there, it's a very, very important cultural tool. Because if we didn't have the cultural tool of this Q, then we wouldn't know who is supposed to get their coffee first, right? And then there would be all kinds of arguments. People would say, no, I want my coffee first and stuff like that. And so it's a very, very important cultural tool. What else is important here? How do you know where the counter is? Yeah. So there's a sign. In fact, the counter itself, the physical counter, right, is an important cultural tool. The physical counter tells you this is where I got my coffee. Right? And it's also useful for putting the coffee on, right, when you're finished, or putting the money on when you want to pay. So this counter is an essential cultural tool for the Pacific Coffee. So I go up to the counter, and then what do? Okay, so I may look at the menu, but I was at the Pacific Coffee this morning, and I didn't look at the menu. You know why? I'm already familiar. I already know what I wanted. So sometimes yes, sometimes not. But actually, what is the action that we're doing? The action is not looking at the menu, right? The action is deciding what we want, right? So you need to decide what you want, right? And there, the menu is probably the most important cultural tool. Menu, signs, advertisements, other people's coffee. You know? Other people's coffee can also be a cultural tool to decide what you want, because you're standing in the queue and you see this really pretty girl who just got this like caramel double mocha frozen coffee, right? And you kind of look at, oh, I'm going to have what she has. Oh, do you often drink that coffee, right? So you could use that cup of coffee as a cultural tool to do many things, right? To buy a cup of coffee, also to get a date with a girl, right? And so the menu, the signs, advertisements, and other people's coffee. I do that in restaurants all the time, don't you? Especially when I go to a foreign country and I can't speak the language. I just go into the restaurant and I walk around and I look at everybody else's food. Do you do that? And then when the waiter comes, I take her around and say, I'm going to have one of those and one of those and one of those. Yeah. Okay, so I decided what I wanted. Now what do I need to do? I need to order. Good. And what do I need to use to order? Language, very important. In fact, I need language up here as well, don't I? In order to read the menu, right? I need to be able to read, right? So I'm actually making use of language here. But here's spoken language. Spoken language. I need to tell the person what I want, okay? In the Pacific Coffee, what kind of languages work as cultural tools in the Pacific Coffee? Can I use English? Can I use Putonghua? Yes. Can I use Guandonghua? Yes. Can I use Tagalog, Filipino language? Maybe. Some of the people who work in the Pacific Coffee are Filipino, you know. Yeah, it might work. Can I use German? Probably wouldn't work. French. Un café. It probably wouldn't work. It probably wouldn't work. And so, not all spoken language, only some spoken language. Right? What kind of sentence can I use? Can I use a request? Can I please have a cappuccino? How about if can I use a question? Right? Do you have chocolate cappuccino? Yeah. Okay. I can use a question. How about a command? Give me a cappuccino. Is that okay? Yeah. How about just a word? Cappuccino. Yeah. So lots of different kinds of sentences I can use to order, right? Lots of different kinds of sentences. Right? So I order, right? Now, when I'm ordering, right, if I just say cappuccino, okay, just say cappuccino, is that the end of the story? No, what's going to happen? No, that's not. No. If I just say cappuccino, is that the end of the ordering? The size is very important, right? So they can say, do you want a tall, large, or grande, you know, or extra grande, or something like this, right? And so the sizes are very, very important. The system of sizes, extremely important. Right? So I say, I want a cup of coffee. And they say, what size? And I say, small. And they say, there's no small. I say, well, what do you mean there's no small? I just want a small coffee. I say, no, we don't have small. I say, oh, how can you not have small? You know, like you have small, medium, and large. So I want a small. I say, no small. This happened to me at the Pacific Coffee. I was like 10 minutes arguing with this person. Right? They said, we don't have small, we just have tall. I said, well, what's the smallest one? Tall. I said, but how can tall be small? It was ridiculous. Right? But it's true. If you go in you'll see, you go in Pacific Coffee, the smallest one is tall. And then it's like grande, and then it's super large or something like that. Right? It's really strange. And so And so I think they understand this at Pacific Coffee. They understand that's a little bit difficult to figure out what, you know, what the sizes are. And so they have a very important cultural tool there to help me. And what's that? In front of the cash register, they have three cups. Yeah? Three cups. Right? So cups are very important. Right? I can say, he can say, what size? I say, I don't know. What size you have? And she can point to the cups. Right? Or she can say, what size? And I can just point to the cup. Right? Stuff like that. Right? In fact, I could probably do the whole thing without talking. You know, I could like point to a cup of coffee and point to the cup and do the whole thing without language. And it's possible sometimes. Right? It's especially easy in McDonald's. Right? You know, because they only have a menu right there. And usually in McDonald's, people don't say anything. They just point. You know, I want that. Or they may use a number, often number two, number three. Something like that. So numbers, cups, all these little systems are very important for ordering. So I ordered. Great. Finished. Now I get my cup of coffee? Oh, what do I need?
Pay.
And what kind of cultural tools do I use to pay?
Money.
And so you can see my ability to take the action of buying a cup of coffee depends on whether or not I have available to me the cultural tools with which to take this action. One of the key cultural tools I need to have available to me is money. If I do not have any money available to me, then I can't buy the coffee. Right? Okay? So no money, no coffee. So how about can I use my I went to Macau last weekend for gambling, you know? I got some Macau money. Right? What is it, like Macau pesos or something they're called? Right? Can I use those in the Pacific Coffee? Do you think so? Will they accept it? How about renminbi? They'll accept renminbi in the Pacific Coffee? Yeah, well, renminbi is worth more than Hong Kong dollars now, actually. They're very happy to get renminbi, so please give me the renminbi. U.S. dollars? Can I use U.S. dollars? I don't think so. I think if I went to the Pacific Coffee Festival walk and used my U.S. dollars, you know, they would say, oh, you can't use... Well, I'm an American. I can use U.S. dollars. No. Sorry. You can't use U.S. dollars now. So it really depends very much on how about if I have a $1,000 note? Is it okay in the Pacific Coffee? $1,000 note? Okay? I think it's probably okay. Maybe in the coffee cart down there, it's not okay. But I think in the Pacific Coffee, it's okay. So I'm using the money. What is she using? What is she using? Or he? He or she? A machine, right? So cash register. In fact, that cash register is so important to the whole operation because the cash register helps her to register the money that I gave her. It produces a receipt so that I have proof that I gave her the money. It displays a figure on a small screen to tell me how much money I owe, so she doesn't even have to say anything, right? You know, sometimes they say something, sometimes they don't. Like, you know, it's like $22. And they'll say, oh, that'll be $22. But if I didn't hear her, I can always look. You know, say, oh, yeah, $22. Yeah, I can look on that little screen. And sometimes, most of them speak English quite well. But sometimes some of them don't speak English so good, and so they don't know how to say numbers very well. Once I went in there, and it was like $22. $2,225, please. I said, what? It's so expensive. And then I looked at, oh, yeah, $22. Okay. No problem. Right? And so that little screen is extremely important. And also, the cash register automatically sends a message to the person who's making the coffee, and it shows up on a little screen there, right? It says they have to make a cappuccino, right? And so that whole machine is very, very important to the whole process. Okay, so what do I do now? What do I do now? Wait. What kinds of cultural tools do I need to wait? Well, time, yeah, patience. Yeah. But actually, waiting is one of the most interesting actions. In fact, people have written entire books about waiting, right? And how people do waiting. And it's, I think it's fascinating. I often observe people waiting in the MTR and other places. You can't just wait. You can't just stand there. Right? You've got to do something. You've always got to look like you're doing something when you're waiting. So people use all sorts of things to wait. They use their mobile phone to wait. They use their iPod to wait. Right? They use a newspaper or a magazine to wait. Or they may use the scenery to wait. They just kind of look around at the scenery, that sort of thing. They may use their watch. You know, they look at their watch to wait. All these kinds of things. So waiting involves, seems very similar, it's actually extremely complicated action that involves a whole variety of different cultural tools. So I've waited, and then my coffee comes. Right? Now, what kinds of cultural tools does the production of my coffee require? Very important. Cup. And what else? You know, the ingredients, so the coffee, water, milk, sugar, etc., etc., etc. Okay. You know? And what else? There's a kind of machine they use. Yeah? The coffee machine. I guess the cappuccino machine or the espresso machine or all these sorts of things, right? So all of these things are essential. Some of them are essential for me getting the cup of coffee, that is for them making the cup of coffee. But it is, I think, the cup that is the most essential for me drinking the cup of coffee. Yeah? Because without the cup, then I won't be able to take the coffee off of the counter, right, and bring it back to my office or sit down or anything like that. Right? So I need the cup. What do I do after I get the cup? I've got my cup. What do I do? Drink. I just stand there at the counter and drink. Thanks.
Take a seat.
Okay. So find a seat. Or I could leave. Yeah, I could leave Pacific Coffee and find someplace else. Right? But I think finding a seat is also a very interesting action in coffee shops, McDonald's, and at other places like this. Very, very fascinating to observe. Very, very interesting to observe. Right? Some people, they might do this action, right, here. Yeah? It's possible. Right? Some people, they don't want to stay in the Pacific Coffee. They don't want to get coffee there if there's no place to sit. Right? So they go to the Pacific Coffee, they find a seat. If they can find a seat, then they'll get the coffee. If they can't find the seat, they say, oh, let's go someplace else. Yeah, something like that. Right? And so finding a seat is very important. And we use all sorts of cultural tools to find a seat. What do we use? Mm-hmm. Our eyes, right? What else do we use? Well, some people use lots of objects to find and to hold their seat. Right? Particularly if they're finding their seat at this part. Right? So if you go into the Pacific Coffee, you can, you know, go up to a table and you can see, wow, notes from Discourse and Pragmatics all over the table. What does that mean? Right? That means that somebody very intelligent is drinking coffee at the Pacific Coffee. Well, it means that somebody's sitting there, right? So whenever you go into a McDonald's or something and you go and you see a bag, right, or you see a purse, or you see a book, or you see some papers, some notes, things like this, you know that somebody is sitting there. And, you know, it's something that's always, I really love about Hong Kong. You know, it's such a wonderful thing about Hong Kong. Because I'm from New York, you know, and if you go into McDonald's in New York and you put your bag down on the table and then you go to buy what you're buying and then you come back, will your bag be there?
No.
100% of the time, your bag will not be there. Okay? Never. Never do that. Even if you leave your notes from Discourse and Pragmatics. I know. They'll take anything. They'll take anything. Still, it's gone. You know? It's gone. So it's really nice. I mean, Hong Kong people are very honest. They're very sweet. You know, they don't steal your bag while you're getting your coffee, you know. So you can put your bag there. I mean, even once I left my computer at the Pacific Coffee, you know, I said, my God, my computer at Pacific Coffee, like 20 minutes ago, you know. And I went back to the Pacific Coffee, it was still there. You know? And nobody was sitting in that seat. because they knew that somebody's sitting there, you know, doing their work. Yeah. Wow, it's just wonderful. It's great. So I find a seat. So the point of doing this is two points. The first point is that you can see that getting a cup of coffee, the action or the practice of getting a cup of coffee is not actually that simple. That it's actually made up of lots of different small actions. Second, in order to do these actions, you need to have certain kinds of cultural tools. Sometimes those cultural tools include discourse, texts. Sometimes they don't include discourse. So as discourse analysts, we need to look at this and say, okay, what are the key? What are the key actions we need to take to get this cup of coffee? And then what are the texts or what are the kinds of discourse that we need to use to do it? Right? And I mean, this kind of analysis that is actually very, very useful if you own a Pacific Coffee, if you want to figure out how to run your Pacific Coffee, and you can figure out, oh, wow, we need to put a sign right here so they know whether we're open, or we need to put a menu here, or we need to put these three cups here, you know, because they're not going to be able to understand our size thing, and we need to give them a way to point to the cups, that sort of thing, right? And so this kind of analysis can help someone who's arranging this kind of situation to arrange it in a more useful way. But there are other more important things about it as well, which I'm going to tell you after you take your break. So let's have a 15-minute break. And so we've been talking about buying a cup of coffee. We spent almost an hour talking about buying a cup of coffee. And now I'm afraid that at the end of the lesson, you're going to go home and your mother's going to ask you, what did you learn in the university today? And you're going to say, well, I learned how to buy a cup of coffee. And she's going to say, I send you to the university to learn high-level things, and they teach you how to buy a cup of coffee. But the point that I'm trying to make in going through buying the cup of coffee, really the main point that I'm going to try to emphasize, is that the discourse or the other cultural tools that we have available to us in these situations not only affect the actions that we can take, but really determine the actions that we can take. For example, if I don't have the money, I can't buy a cup of coffee. And so, depending on what kind of cultural tools are available to us, we can take certain kinds of actions. That is, certain cultural tools allow us to take certain kinds of actions, whereas other cultural tools allow us to take different kinds of actions. So the way we say this in mediated discourse analysis is that cultural tools have affordances and constraints. Affordances means that it makes certain kinds of actions easier. Constraints means that it makes certain kinds of actions more difficult. For example, a microphone. I may be in a lecture theater with 400 people using a microphone to talk to all of these people. Yeah? And the microphone allows me to talk to a whole bunch of different people. And so that's its affordance, right? The affordance is it makes the action of talking to a large group of people possible. But it doesn't make the action of telling somebody a secret possible, right? So I find my microphone say, Bowie, I'm going to tell you a secret. Don't tell anybody else. You know, and of course everyone else can hear. Then I just can't do it. So the microphone makes the action of telling a secret impossible. So that's the constraint of a microphone. When you go into the Pacific Coffee, they say, would you like your coffee in a paper cup or a china cup? You know? And, you know, if you have it in a paper cup, that allows you to do certain kinds of things with your coffee. What does it allow you to do? Leave. Yes? You can leave the Pacific Coffee without drinking your coffee. But if you get a china cup, you ever try that? You get a china cup and you just sort of walk out. You see in my office many china cups collected from the Pacific Coffee. Well, you can't do it, right? So the china cup doesn't allow you. So that's the constraint of the china cup. But what is the affordance of the china cup? The china cup has this little handle. Yeah? So the affordance is that you can drink your coffee without burning your fingers. Right? Okay? And so the different kinds of cups have different affordances and different kinds of constraints. So they make certain kinds of actions possible. Right? But along with making certain kinds of actions possible, they also make certain kinds of identities possible. For example, a medical chart. Right? If you're sick, you're in the hospital, right? You're lying in the bed in the hospital, at the foot of your bed on a clipboard is a medical chart. Right? Tells all the times you had your injection. Right? Tells all the times you went to the toilet. Right? Tells all the times you ate that day. Right? And it's hanging there. And then the doctor will come in sometimes, pick up your chart, look through it, and go, and put it down and leave. Right? His being able to handle that chart shows that he's a doctor. Right? The nurse will come and maybe write things in the chart. Right? Her writing things in the chart shows that she's the nurse, because there are a lot of other people around as well, like maybe your family members come to visit you, your sister or your friend from the university comes to visit you. They usually don't pick up the chart and say, oh, I see you went to the toilet at 3 o'clock today. Right? They don't. In fact, if they do, the nurse will scold them. Say, no, you can't look at that. Right? That's only for doctors and nurses. And so that particular cultural tool is used only for certain people. And when people use it, they're showing that I'm this person. Right? So the guy in the white coat who walks up, even if I never saw this guy before, right? I just had an accident, you know, I'm like, right? And this guy comes, he has a white coat, he picks up the chart, I know he's a doctor. I don't think he's like the cleaning person or something like that. I know who he is. So cultural tools also have an important part to do with showing identity, showing who you are. And the reason for this, the reason why we use cultural tools in different ways, and the reason they have this relationship with identity, is that cultural tools accumulate the history of their previous use. Right?
Sorry about that.
They accumulate the history of their previous use. And so everyone who's used this paper cup in this certain way before, right, takes it out of the shop. Right? They don't finish the coffee and bring it back up and say, I'm finished with the coffee, here's the cup. Right? And so that practice being done over and over again, right, gives this particular cultural tool, this cup, its characteristics, its history. Right? Its history not only in that Pacific coffee, but in all the Pacific coffees in Hong Kong and the whole world and all the coffee shops everywhere, and also the McDonald's and every place where you get these paper cups, you know what to do. Right? Because we always do the same thing with the paper cup. And so that brings me to the second point about these actions. Right? Buying a cup of coffee is a kind of action in itself, right? But we can see that it's made up of lots of little tiny actions. Right? One action, you know, going to the coffee shop, going through the door, going to the counter, deciding what you want, ordering, paying, all of these smaller actions. And all of these smaller actions are arranged in a certain sequence, right? You've got to do them in order, don't you? Right? You can't drink your coffee and then decide what kind of coffee you want. It doesn't make sense. Right? And so the actions have to follow in some kind of specific sequential order. So we call these chains of action. So each action is kind of linked to the next action in like a chain. Yeah? But then after a while, so you can say that the buying the cup of coffee is the big action, and inside of the big action you have all of these smaller actions. Yeah? So you can call buying a cup of coffee a higher order action, and all of these other things as lower order actions. Big actions and small actions. Now the thing about big actions is that often we do these big actions, we do these sequences of small actions to make these big actions in exactly the same way over and over again. For example, when I go to the Pacific Coffee, I follow this set of actions every single time exactly the same way. Right? From the first time I went to the Pacific Coffee to the last time I go to the Pacific Coffee, I just do it over and over and over and over again. And so, I know how to do it. You know? So when I say, let's get a cup of coffee, right? We don't have to say, well, what should we do first? Should we order or should we pay? We don't have to have that discussion, right? Because we know what's involved in getting a cup of coffee. So this is what we call a social practice. So a social practice is a special kind of action. It's a special kind of action that we do the same way every single time. Right? It's a special kind of action that's so special that we can't even put a label on it. The label, getting a cup of coffee. Right? And so when I say, let's get a cup of coffee, it automatically includes all of these small actions. I already know. Right? How do I know? Habit, isn't it? It's a habit. Right? It's something that has gotten into my mind. But more than gotten into my mind, it's kind of gotten into my body. Do you know what I mean? Right? That it's just so automatic, like driving a car, playing basketball, right? Going through the MTR. Right? We have a habit of going through the MTR. We don't have to think about going through the MTR. We go, we see the turnstile, we take out our wallet, we go like this, we continue. We don't have to think. Right? But sometimes you can see people, they go up there, and they go, oh, and they try to stick it in here and put it up there. They're tourists. They're called tourists, okay? And or illegal immigrants. Right? And the police, they look for these people. Right? They do. When they, you know, the policemen in the MTR, when they check IDs, they watch people. Right? And the people who seem to be doing everything very automatically, they don't worry about. But the people who are doing things non-automatically, like reading signs and doing this and not sure, they figure, oh, they're not from here. Right? So the point is that the habit is not just in our head, but it's in our whole body. And Pierre Bourdieu, the French sociologist, calls this habitus. Right? So habitus is just this collection of practices, habits that you have inside of you, right? From birth, right? You develop from birth over and over again. You do the same thing over and over again, right? And so you have this practice inside of you, inside of your habitus, right? All of the other people around you have the same practices inside their habitus, inside their bodies. Right? And so we call this group of people a community of practice. What joins us together is that we all do the same thing, the same way. Right? We all go to the Pacific Coffee and buy coffee in the same way. We all go to class in the same way. Right? We all go to karaoke in the same way. We all meet at McDonald's in the same way. We have the same habits inside our body. That is, we have the same practices inside our body. This is Bourdieu's definition of habitus. Systems of durable, transposable dispositions, structures predispositioned to function as structuring structures. That is, as principles which generate and organize practices and representations that can be objectively adapted to their outcomes without presupposing conscious aiming at ends or an express mastery of the operations necessary in order to attain them. Everyone get that? Rubbish. So dense, so difficult to understand this definition. Right? Basically what Bourdieu is saying is that practices are the things that get inside of us that become automatic. So we don't have to consider them. We don't have to be conscious about, oh, I'm going to have a cup of coffee. What should I do next? What is my goal in having a cup of coffee? Right? We don't have to think of all of these things. It's just automatic, right? Just like a habit, right? We're not going to be using, in mediated discourse analysis, we don't use the word habitus. We use another word, which I think is a better word, the historical body, right? That the practice gets inside of your historical body. Right? And so when you do the practice the next time, you know exactly how to do it because all of it's there. And the more you do it, the more automatic it becomes. Right? The more you play basketball, the better you are at playing basketball, right? Because the more automatic it is. You don't have to think. In the beginning when you're playing basketball, you need to think, oh, what am I supposed to do now? And what's he doing? And where's the ball? And what's this? But when you play a long time, then it's automatic, isn't it? It just gets into your body. Driving a car. First time you drive a car, right? You have to think, oh, okay, this is the brake. This is the gas. I got to steer here. I got to do this. You read the signs very carefully. But then after you've been driving for many years, it's very automatic, right? You don't see the taxi driver say, okay, which is the brake and which is the gas? If you ever see that, get out of the taxi, right? There's this idea of karma, which I think is actually quite a good kind of analogy for habitus. Right? So karma, the Buddhist idea of karma, is basically the kinds of actions that we do over and over again. And the idea that every time we do an action, it affects us somehow. All right? That it basically affects us to make it easier for us to do the same action again. So if you kill somebody, all right, basically what that creates for you is it makes it easier for you to kill the next person, right? And to kill the next person, and to kill the next person, until killing becomes a kind of habit for you, right? Or you know, you get angry at people, right? So you get angry, right? And then the next time something happens, and you get angry again, right? And then you just get into this habit of getting angry, right? Until it becomes a kind of social practice for you. So the historical body is very, very much like this, right? It's just how things get into our bodies and our consciousness and our experience like this. And so you can see that there's a kind of relationship between the historical body, the individual, the social practice, and the community, right? So the person does the social practice over and over again, and so the social practice becomes part of their historical body, right? But the social practice is also the same as the social practice that all these other people do around me, right? And so when the historical body does the social practice, they show that they're a member of this group. When I go to the Pacific Coffee and I buy a cup of coffee successfully, I'm showing that I'm a member of Hong Kong society. Right? If I walk into the Pacific Coffee and say, what's coffee? Coffee. How do I get coffee? Excuse me, how can I get some coffee here? People will say, are you strange? Are you a foreigner? Are you from someplace else? You don't know how to get a cup of coffee? Right? So I'm showing I'm a foreigner. I'm not part of the community. Right? Every time you play basketball with your friends, right, and you play well, you're showing that you're a group of basketball players. You're a member of this group. Right? If you go and you just start playing basketball and, you know, you throw the ball in all the wrong places and you don't know what you're doing, people say, you don't know how to play. You're not part of our group. You're not a basketball player. You're not part of the team, right? Because you can't do the practice. So doing the practice shows you're a member of the community, right? By showing a member of the community, the practice gets more into your historical body, and the more it gets into your historical body, the more you do it, the more it shows that you're part of the community. So these practices have a relationship with the other people around us as well, right? They bind us to our social groups. And our social groups are simply groups of people who do these practices over and over and over again, right? So here's a more complicated diagram, right? So we have the actor, that's you, and the other that you're doing it with, and the cultural tools that you're using. And when you use these cultural tools to do these kinds of practices, you claim identity in a particular community of practice, or you impute identity on somebody else, right? So impute identity means that you say that they're a certain kind of person. So when I go up to a person and say, could I please have a cup of coffee? I'm imputing, or I'm saying that they have a certain kind of identity as the coffee person, the person, the server, the cashier, the person who's supposed to give me a cup of coffee, right? Do you ever do that? Do you ever go into a shop, right? And you're in a shop, and you say, I wonder if you have this in, like, a medium size? And they say, oh, I don't work here. That ever happened to you? Oh, I'm not the sales here. I'm just another customer, right? That happens to me sometimes, you know? You're not really sure who's the sales there, right? And so when you're asking a question like that, like, do you have this in a medium, you're imputing a certain identity on somebody, right? You're saying that they're a certain kind of person, that they have this particular kind of, they have this particular kind of role. Condoms. We all should know that we should use condoms to prevent early pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, right? But some people, like, they go out with their girlfriend or their boyfriend for a little while, and maybe they'll use condoms, but after a while, maybe they'll stop using condoms, right? And this is actually a quote from a girl. She says, if he really loves me and I really trust him, then it's okay. We don't have to use the condom, right? So we can see the condom here is a cultural tool. But the action is taken by not using the condom. By not using the condom, the guy shows the girl that I'm a trustworthy man. You can trust me. You can trust me. It's it's okay. And the girl is showing the guy, oh, I really love you. And so not using the cultural tool is also a way of claiming and imputing identity, right? So if the girl lets the guy not use the condom, she's giving to him the identity of a trustworthy man. And she's showing to him an identity of a loving girlfriend, right? And this is actually, it's a problem, isn't it? Right? It's a problem because maybe they still should use the condom, you know? But since the condom is so connected with these identities, it becomes difficult to use the condom in the love relationship, right? And suddenly it becomes difficult because the condom is not just a condom. The condom is connected to certain kinds of ideas, certain kinds of identities. So the whole point of this, I think, the most important point of this is who is in charge, right? We take all of these actions over and over again, all day long. We do these actions. Who is in charge of deciding whether we're going to do these actions? We usually think that we're the people in charge. We usually think that, well, I decide whether I want a cup of coffee, and I decide how I get the cup of coffee. And, you know, I'm the one who's in charge. We call this idea agency. Agency is the person who's in charge, the person who's doing an action. So if I have a sentence, I kissed her, the agent of the sentence is I, right? I is the person who's doing the action, right? But if you really think about it, you can't really say that I is the only powerful person in this sentence, right? Because suppose I want to kiss her, but she doesn't let me. Yeah? Then I can't kiss her. And so she, even though she's like a passive agent, she's being kissed in this sentence, she also has a certain amount of agency, doesn't she? Right? She also has a certain amount of say in determining whether this action gets completed, right? Because if she doesn't cooperate with this action, then the action can't be completed. And so agency is actually really complicated, right? Agency is usually not a matter of just one person. In fact, usually in any situation, the agency, who is in charge, who is determining what's going to happen next, is distributed among the different social actors involved, among the different cultural tools involved, and among the different social practices involved. So I'll give you an example of a filling out a form, right? You think that you fill out the form. You think that you're the person who's doing the action, right? So you have to fill out a form for a scholarship. You want to get the Rodney Jones Memorial Scholarship, yeah? And so you fill out the form, right? And you think, I'm filling out the form. I'm doing the action. I'm the one who's determining everything here. I'm in charge, right? But are you really in charge? Can you write down anything you want on this form? Right? If they say, for example, describe your experiences in City University, can you write down, well, I went to the Pacific Coffee yesterday, and I had a really nice chat. And, you know, can you do that? You can't, right? And so the form already determines what you're supposed to write on the form, doesn't it? Right? So the question is, are you filling out the form, or is the form filling out you? You know what I mean? Some forms, they ask you if you're married or not, you know? And in Chinese, they have two choices. They can say, okay, 结婚, yeah, or 未婚, right? Now, what does 未婚 mean? Not yet married. 未 means not yet, isn't it? Yeah? So 未 means not yet married, right? One is married, and the other is not yet married, right? I always thought this was really, like, suppose, like, a Buddhist monk is filling out this form. Right? You know, Buddhist monk with a shaved head, never going to get married. Right? And he gets to this point, and he gets to this question, what does he write? Right? Like, not married. Well, he's not married, so he can't write married. But then he can't really say not yet married because he's not going to get married. Or maybe it's like a 95-year-old woman. You know? What's she going? Not yet, but I'm still hoping. Right? So you can see that really the form itself, right, is exerting a lot of agency in the situation. The forum itself is determining how you fill it out. You think you're in charge. You think you're doing the action. But actually, in many ways, the discourse is doing the action for you. That is, the discourse is forcing you or causing you to do the action in a certain way. And this is why it's so important to look at what kinds of discourse are available to us in different situations, because the kinds of discourse that are available to us in different situations is going to determine how we take the action. We're not free. I'm sorry. I wish we were free, but we're not free, right? That is, we can only take the actions that we can take with the particular cultural tools that we have available to us, right? And so if I don't have a cup available to me, I can't drink this tea. Right? No way I can drink this tea. And so, basically, there are four ways that we're controlled by these actions and by these cultural tools. One way is we're controlled by the tools that are available to us. Another way is we're controlled by what we can do with these tools. What are the particular affordances and constraints of these tools? The third way is from the practices that the tools are associated with, and I'll talk about that in a second. And then the last one is what I call the funnel of commitment, and I'll have a special slide for that, and I'll get to that. Right. So, previous. So the first two are things that we've already talked about. What are the cultural tools available to us, right, in the interaction? So, for example, in the coffee shop, right, there are certain tools that are available to me and certain tools that are available to the coffee makers, right? I may like my coffee in a certain way, a very special way. Only I can do it, right? But I can't get that special coffee in the Pacific Coffee because I do not have the coffee machine available to me. I can't go in the Pacific Coffee and say, oh, I'll just come back there and make it myself. I can't do it. I don't have that tool available to me, right? And so I can't take that particular kind of action. In that workplace interaction we looked at, the man has the telephone available to him, right? And so he can use the telephone to show something about the power between the two people. She doesn't have that cultural tool available to them. And so different kinds of tools are available to different kinds of people, and different kinds of tools make different kinds of actions possible. The pressure of practice. The pressure of practice is that because this is a social practice that we've done over and over again, it's deep inside our historical body, it's deep inside our habitus. There's so many imprints on our mind from this practice that we're kind of forced always to do it in the same way. It's difficult for us to do it in a different way. Not only that, if we do it in a different way, other people in our community of practice will say, what are you doing? What are you doing? That's not the way to do it, you know? So if somebody comes to the basketball, right, and they're dressed in, like, ski equipment, right, and they say, I'm going to try a new kind of basketball using skis or something like this, right, you're going to say, no, you can't do that. That's not the way you play basketball, right? It's not the way we do this practice. So there's a kind of pressure that comes both from our inside and from our society to do the thing in the same way all the time. If you do it differently, then people will criticize you. And so you've got to do it in a kind of recognizable way that other people will say, oh yeah, you're doing this practice. I used to work at a secondary school in Hong Kong, and I taught English literature. Yeah, there are some students in secondary school who study English literature in Hong Kong, and I was their teacher. And in order to prepare for my lessons, I had to read many books, novels, poems, dramas, the great works of English literature. So I need to refamiliarize myself with these great works of English literature. Now, you know, in secondary schools, the teacher's room is just like the classroom, right? That all the teacher's desks are in rows like this, and then the headmaster or the panel chair sits in the front of the room just like the teacher, right, and watches, you know? And so every day I go in there, you know, to prepare for my lesson, right? And I have all my books of poetry, right? And I sit there and read the poetry. And, you know, sometimes I put my feet up and I read the poetry like this. And my headmaster got very angry. Right? Talked to my panel chair. Said, I don't think that Mr. Jones is working, you know? Because every time I see him, he's reading, right? And so for him, the action of reading did not signal the practice of working, Right? In order to be working, you needed to sit at your chair like this with a red pen, yes, and a stack of scripts. Right? And then you need to take one script and you need to make this kind of action. And like this. And that kind of action signals that I'm doing the practice. Right? And so there's always a pressure to do the things the same way that everyone else is doing them, isn't it? Right? So that's what we call the pressure of practice. The funnel of commitment has to do with how all of the smaller actions that make up the social practice exert pressure on each other in a kind of sequential way. And so as you progress in the action, it becomes much more difficult to stop doing the action. The example is the coffee shop. Right? If you want to get a cup of coffee, and you go to the Civic Coffee, right? So you get here, right? And then you're standing outside the Pacific Coffee and you say, no, I don't want coffee after all. I think I'll have tea. I'll go someplace else. Alright? And then you can leave. It's very easy. Okay? But then when you enter the Pacific Coffee, then you can still decide, oh, I don't want to stay. Let's go someplace else. It's a little bit harder because you're already inside. But you can still do it. Yeah? No problem. Alright? Then you get up to the counter and you're waiting in the queue. Alright? And some people in front of you, some people behind you. Alright? And then you suddenly think, I don't think I want a cup of coffee. You can still leave, but it's a little harder. It's a little harder to leave. Right? Then you get up to the counter, right? And you order your cup of coffee. Right? You say, please give me a cappuccino. Right? And then you think, oh, no, I'm sorry, I don't want a cappuccino. I want a hamburger. Bye. You can still do it, but it's embarrassing, isn't it? It's more difficult. Right? So you might think, oh, I guess I'll get a cup of coffee. Yeah. Right? And then, right, when you pay for your cup of coffee and you get your cup of coffee, right, can you say, oh, I don't think I want this cup of coffee. Excuse me, I don't want this cup of coffee. Can I have my money back, please? No. You can't do it, can you? You become committed, right, to the social practice of having a cup of coffee. So as you go through this chain of actions, right, as you go from one action to the next action, to the next action, you become more and more committed to doing the social practice. It becomes harder and harder to back out of doing the social practice. This is why we call it the funnel of commitment. Do you know what a funnel is? It's this kind of thing. Huh? That's a funnel, right? So the liquid goes down the funnel. And in the beginning, it's okay. It can kind of get out if it wants to. But as it goes further down, more and more and more, then it's committed to going into the bottle. Right? So that's why we call it the funnel of commitment. Right? With each successive action, the chain of actions becomes more difficult to reverse the funnel of commitment. And the funnel of commitment becomes even more difficult when the action involves somebody else. Right? Because they're sharing the funnel of commitment to you. So if he says, what would you like? Right, that puts pressure on me to say, a cappuccino. Right? And once I've said a cappuccino, it puts pressure on him to say, that'll be $22, please. And once he said $22, that puts pressure on me to give him $22. I can't say, I'm not going to give you $22. Right? That's outrageous. No, I've got to give it to him. Right? And so it's like a tennis match or something like that, right? Each time somebody hits the ball to me, I've got to hit it back. I can't just let it go, right? I've got to hit it back somehow, right? And so that's part of the funnel of commitment. When we do actions with other people, we share in creating this kind of momentum for the social practice to go forward. And so you can see, whenever we do any kind of action, we get pressure from two sides, right? First, we get pressure from up here, right? From the society we live in, from the cultural tools that we're using, and from our own historical bodies, puts pressure on us to do that action in a certain kind of way. But there's also pressure from below, right? The pressure that one action exerts upon the next action, exerts upon the next action, exerts upon the next action, until finally, in the end, here we are, we've already had a cup of coffee, right? And we think we had the cup of coffee, but actually, the cup of coffee had us. Right? The cup of coffee had us, right? Because we didn't make any decisions in the end in having that cup of coffee. We walked into the door and it was just like automatic. It happened. It happened. And I mean, that's a very, very important thing to think about, right? When you think about your own decision-making process and your own willpower within particular situations. What time is it now? 6? Huh? Okay, good. So I want to move on to explaining to you how you do this kind of analysis. Yeah? And the way we do this kind of analysis has a special name called nexus analysis. It's kind of a special name, a little bit of a scary name. You don't have to worry about the name. What's more important is the kind of method. And the kind of method is actually very simple. Right? The method is whenever you go into a situation, you try to focus on the social actions. Right? What are the social actions? What's going on here? And then in order to figure out how and why people are taking actions the way they're taking them, is you look at three things. The first thing you look at is what we call discourses in place. But that's just another word for cultural tools. You look at what cultural tools are available. So here in the Pacific Coffee, we have the coffee cups, we have the coffee machines, we have the signs, we have the menu, we have the sofas, we have the tables, we have the computers, right? We have all of these different discourses in place or cultural tools available to do certain kinds of actions. The second thing you look at is the historical body. You look at the person who's doing the action, right? And you say, well, have they ever done this kind of thing before? Do they have the habit of drinking coffee? Do they have the habit of buying coffee in the Pacific Coffee? Because if they do have that habit inside of their historical body, then they're going to do it in a certain way. But if they don't have that habit, then they're going to do it in a very different way. And then the last thing you look at is what we call the interaction order. The interaction order means the relationships between the different people in the Pacific Coffee, right? Or in whatever kind of situation. So I may be at the Pacific Coffee with my friend getting a cup of coffee, right? And I'm talking to the clerk who's going to sell me the cashier who's going to sell me the coffee, right? So I have a certain relationship with this cashier and I have a certain relationship with my friend, right? So I can say things to my friend like, oh, how's your boyfriend? You know, is he still beating you? Or something like this, right? But I can't say that to the woman in, you know, the cashier. I can't say, I'll have a cappuccino. By the way, how's your boyfriend? I can't do it because we have a certain kind of relationship. And so we call these relationships the interaction order. So let me give you an example of how to do this kind of analysis. And I'll give a very, very simple example. The example of crossing the street. We all know how to cross the street, right? Crossing the street is a social practice, right? We've practiced crossing the street quite a number of times, right? I know how to cross the street. You know how to cross the street. But crossing the street is one of the important things that children need to learn, isn't it? When you're a mother or a father, you always need to teach your child how to cross the street, how, where to look, when to go, and that sort of thing, right? And so here's a street corner, right? Now, this street corner is not a street corner in Hong Kong. It's a street corner somewhere else. I think it's in America, right? And here we have a street, and here we have some people crossing the street. Now, what kinds of cultural tools do they have available to them to cross the street? What do you think? They have the traffic light, okay? So where's the traffic light? Here. There's a traffic light there, and that will help them to cross the street. That's a very important cultural tool. What else do they have? Yeah, these things, right? So they have these zebra crossings, and that's a very, very important cultural tool that they use. So these are the discourses in place, the cultural tools that they have available to help them to cross the street, right? But that's not all they use to cross the street. So first, they have the historical body, right? That is, they have the fact that they've crossed the street many times, right? They've crossed the street hundreds, thousands, maybe millions of times in their lives. And so they know how to cross the street, right? They know what to do, right? It's inside of their historical body. Sometimes the way of crossing the street in Hong Kong is inside of your historical body, but you're in Beijing. Yeah? And actually the way to cross the street in Beijing is slightly different, right? Or you're in America. The way to cross the street in America is slightly different. Italy, have you ever tried to cross the street in Italy? Don't even try. Okay? So every place actually is different. It's slightly different in crossing the street. Sometimes the cars will stop for you. You know, sometimes the cars, if they see a pedestrian, they'll speed up. Right? It's true. It's true. And so your historical body may go with the place that you're crossing the street, but it may not. If it does, right, then actually this and this, not so important. Not so important. You don't have to say, oh, zebra stripes. Oh. Right? Sometimes you don't even look. Oh, what's the light? You just look and see if cars are coming, isn't it? Right? So if you're very practiced in this, then sometimes the cultural tools that are available, they don't even seem very important. You don't even have to think about using them, or maybe you don't even have to use them. Right? But if you're in a place where you don't know how to cross the street, then you've got to look, oh, what does the sign say? Oh, how do I do this? And what's going on here? Right? I always have trouble in Holland when I cross the street, you know? Because I'm getting ready to cross the street, and I look this way, no cars. I look this way, no cars. And I start to cross the street, and I get hit by a bicycle. Yeah? Because they have lots of bicycles in Holland, right? Every street has a bicycle. And I never, it's not in my historical body to look for bicycles. You know? When I go out and cross the street in Hong Kong, I don't say, any bicycles around? Because there are never any bicycles around in Hong Kong, right? And so your historical body, depending on where you're from, your historical body for crossing the street is going to be quite different. Then we have our discourses in place, right? But there's another very, very important aspect to crossing the street, and that is the interaction order, right? And so if you're at an intersection getting ready to cross the street and you decide, okay, now it's a good time to cross the street, all the people waiting there with you, a bunch of people waiting, and you think, now's a good time to cross the street. You start crossing the street, and nobody else is doing it. You just like, don't you, right? And so we also use other people, don't we, right, to tell us whether or not it's a good, especially if you're in a foreign country. If you're in a foreign country, I always cross the street with the locals. You know, I just like get next to a local person, and I cross the street with them, right? Because I figure they know how to do it, right? You may be in certain situations. You may be a small child, right? In which case, the interaction order you have with your mother is very important for crossing the street, right? You may be with your boyfriend, yeah? And when you cross the street, your boyfriend holds your hand. Any of you have that? It's really sweet, isn't it? Right? You're crossing the street, your boyfriend holds your hand. Right? Now, you may think, but wait a minute, I'm not a child. You don't have to take me across the street. But he's actually using the action of holding your hand to show, oh, he cares about you, something like that, right? So he may hold your hand. And so you can see they're holding hands right there, right? So you can see the interaction order, right, is also very, very important in determining whether we cross the street successfully. This is Counter-Strike. Does anyone play Counter-Strike? No? Terry, you don't play Counter-Strike? None of you play Counter-Strike? It's a little bit old. I know. I understand. You all know what Counter-Strike is, yeah? Counter-Strike is an online game. And the purpose of this game, the action that you need to take when you play this game, is killing people. All right? And so in order to take this action of killing people, you have various cultural tools available to you. For example, you have a gun, right? And you also have certain kinds of perspective, walls. So you can see in front of you, but you can't see behind you. Right? So the perspective of this game has certain affordances and constraints. The affordance is that by only being able to see in front of you, then you are, it's very realistic. Right? You really feel like you're there. Right? It really creates this feeling like, oh, you're really there. But it also makes it difficult to know what's happening behind you. In some other computer games, right, like fighting games and stuff like that, you can see who's behind you. You can see, oh, the monster's coming in behind me, right, or in front of you, and you can fight in that way. But in this way, very, very special kind of perspective. So it creates affordances, but it also creates constraints. And you also have various kinds of discourses in place, various kinds of other cultural tools available to you, right? So you have different numbers here, right? Showing, for example, how much ammunition you have or how much money you have to buy different kinds of ammunition, right? You have this. This is actually a conversation, right? This is a conversation you can have with your other teammates, right? So you can communicate with your other teammates to find out where they are and if they killed somebody, to make sure you don't kill them. Whenever I play this game, I always kill my teammates. So nobody wants to play this. Nobody wants to play this this game with me, right? The interaction order of this game is actually quite interesting. It's an online game. So sometimes people play it online, like I'm at my house and you're at your house and we're playing it online. Maybe we're even strangers, we don't even know each other. But I've been studying a group of secondary school students who play Counter-Strike, and what they do is they don't like to stay at home and play Counter-Strike. Right? What they like to do is they like to go with their friends to a mongba. You know what a mongba is? Right? They go with their friends to a mongba, and they all sit together, right? And they play Counter-Strike. They all sit together. It's an online game, okay? They're online, playing a game online with somebody who's sitting right next to them, okay? I think it's really weird, right? But they like it. But in this case, they even have more cultural tools available to them. Because not only do they have all this stuff, right, but they also have their voices, so they can actually talk to each other while they're playing as well, right? Or make gestures to each other while they're playing as well, right? But the interaction order is much larger than that, right? When you play Counter-Strike, when you take the action of playing Counter-Strike, when you take the action of killing somebody in Counter-Strike, you're showing that you're a certain kind of person, that you belong to a certain kind of community. When you are able to do the practice of Counter-Strike, right? When you have the practice of playing Counter-Strike inside of your body, inside of your historical body, then you can show that you're a member of the group of people who play Counter-Strike. If you get on and you're like me, you're killing your own teammates and you don't know where to go and you know you're shooting yourself and all these terrible things, then the other people say, you can't play. You're not a Counter-Strike player. You're a fake. Right? You don't belong in this community. They won't play with me. See, they won't play with me. Right? So there are these like groups of people, right? Like teams, right? Crews of Counter-Strike players. Here's an example of one. We're a bunch of Counter-Strike and fun lovers. Abide by the server rules, and you'll definitely enjoy playing here. And they have the rules: no cheating, and cheaters will be bad. So you can join this group. Right? But in order to join this group, you have to use the cultural tool of their set of rules, right? And you have to follow their set of rules, right? But the secondary school kids who play Counter-Strike, they actually use Counter-Strike as a tool to do quite a lot of other things as well. Actually, many of them use Counter-Strike as a tool for learning, yeah? As a tool for learning. Now, maybe their mothers don't think so, or maybe their teachers don't think so, but that they think so, right? And so they tell me things like, you know, when you play Counter-Strike, you learn a lot of stuff, you know? You learn how to build up social networks, right? Because you're communicating with lots of other players all over the place. You learn how to interact with others, how to negotiate things with others. You learn, you know, rules about how to act. You get to learn all that stuff, right? And so for me, a cultural tool with which to do the action of learning is like a book, right, or a PowerPoint presentation or a lecture. But for this particular kid playing this game is a cultural tool which he thinks he can use to learn. Some of them even use Counter-Strike to do homework, right? They think that actually Counter-Strike is very useful for doing homework. One kid says, I have no trouble studying and memorizing things and playing games. I think it works quite well. Yeah. Faster. Right? As I have to think while I'm playing the games, I have already started thinking. And my brain is already functioning. So it's faster for me to study. Right? So this guy really has the idea that he studies better when he's playing Counter-Strike, because it gets his mind going, that sort of thing. So he uses Counter-Strike as a tool to do homework. Back in the computer classroom where we started. Right? So this is a MMLC. You know what an MMLC is? Did you have one in your secondary school? Multimedia Learning Center. Right? Now, the Multimedia Learning Center also has a kind of interaction order. We have this person standing up here, and she's, who's she? The teacher. And who are they? How can you tell? Because she's standing up there, and they're sitting there, right? So that's the interaction order. Or it's enforced. They always have to have that interaction order in this particular situation. They also have a number of cultural tools there, right? They have all these computers that they can use to learn English or whatever, right? And the teacher has her own special cultural tool in the front, yeah? And that's a computer monitor where she can monitor what's going on the screen of all the other students in the room. Right? It's amazing. Right? So she can check to see if they're actually doing the exercises, or are they chatting on MSN, or are they playing Counter-Strike, or what are they doing? Right? And so this allows her to monitor her students. Right? So this good cultural tool, it has the affordance of allowing her to monitor what her students are doing on their screens. But the problem is that when she's standing there, she can see what's happening on her students' screens, but she can't actually see her students because they're covered up by these big monitors in front of them. All right? And so while she's looking at the screen, the students are behind their monitors playing, doing things, you know, passing notes to each other, right, chatting with each other, that kind of thing. So although her computer monitor has the affordance of letting her see what they're doing on the screen, it has the constraint of not allowing them, her, to see what they're doing physically in the classroom. In order for her to see what they're doing physically in the classroom, she has to walk back here. Right? And now I can see what, she can see what you guys are doing. Right? And she can see, oh, what one particular student is doing. But she can't monitor everyone else's computer screen. And so while she's here, the guy over there is playing Counter-Strike with the friend over there, right? And so the whole classroom is set up with these kinds of affordances and constraints. Funny thing about this classroom, this is a real classroom. I videoed this classroom in Hong Kong. The teacher brought her students into the classroom, right? And the computers everywhere, you know? Everyone was sitting behind a computer, and the teacher said, okay, please take out your books. Hello? Right? And so and the students, after I videoed this, I talked to the students, and the students said, yeah, we usually go to the computer room to do book stuff. Right? So what she was actually having the students do here was she was having them open their book and read a passage of their book into the computer. Right? So read a passage, record the passage, and then she could listen to the passage. That sort of thing, right? But what she was actually doing, as the student said, was using computers to teach book content, was that she wasn't actually using a computer as a computer, was she? She was using a computer as a tape recorder, right? So why do you even need a computer, right? All of the things that you use, that you usually use a computer for, like chatting with your friends, surfing the internet, and playing Counter-Strike, right, are things that you weren't allowed to do in this classroom. And so all of the students in this classroom, well, many of the students in this classroom, felt like this. Right? They were not at all interested in doing this kind of activity because their historical body had some kind of ideas about practices that they're supposed to do with computers. Right? When you sit in front of a computer, what are you supposed to do? Chat with your friends, surf the internet, download music. Do many things, actually. Do many things. Right? But here they were in front of these computers, and they weren't allowed to do anything that you usually use computers to do. They were only allowed to read a book. How many people go home, sit in front of their computer, and read a book? Impossible, right? And so the historical body, the practices inside of the historical body of the students, doesn't match with the practices that the teacher wants the students to do. And so it's not surprising that the students are going to talk to their classmates, that they're going to act up, and that they're going to use the cultural tools in different ways, right? And so, of course, these headphones are supposed to be used in order to listen to to the teacher's instructions, but this student is using these headphones to cover his eyes so that he can take a nap, right? And so sometimes we can actually adapt cultural tools to different kinds of situations and different kinds of purposes. How's our time now? Okay, just about right. So we're not going to have time to do this last exercise, but what I'd like you to do is to try to apply this principle of nexus analysis to the interaction that we read last week, or the conversation between the man and the woman that we read last week. Ask yourself, okay, what's the interaction order here? Right? What is the relationship between these people? What are the discourses in place? What are the cultural tools that they have available to them to take actions? What about their historical bodies? Is there something inside of these people that makes them have a habit of using tools in a particular way or taking actions in a particular way? And finally, what exactly are they doing? What are the key actions that they're taking? So maybe you can just look at that in your spare time. Saturday night, you feel bored, nothing to do. Yeah, you can have a look at that, think about nexus analysis, and then maybe at the beginning of class next week, you can tell me what you found out. Okay? So what you need to do in your site of investigation now is you need to do the same thing. You need to go to your site of investigation and say, okay, what's going on here? What are the actions? Okay, I mean my family. What are the actions? Okay, well, my father is scolding my little brother, we're eating yum cha together, right? We're playing mahjong, right? So list all of these actions. And then list the kinds of cultural tools that are available to the people in taking these actions. Okay? Any questions? Okay, great. I'll see you all next week.